Hello and welcome to Albion Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Today we are up to part three of another view of the civil rights movement, the bus boycott. This was the beginning of the civil rights movement in Montgomery. We knew we would face many crisis situations and our patience would be tried many times. I was a lieutenant in the Records and Identification Bureau of the Montgomery Police Department when Rosa Parks was arrested on December 1, 1955 for violating the segregation bus laws. After her arrest, E.D. Nixon found out about it and he called Clifford Durr, an attorney and a white man active in the civil rights movement. Together, they made her bond. The boycott of the buses began on December 5th. The black ministers and others decided to put out leaflets stating, "Don't ride the bus to work, to town, to school, or any place on Monday, December 5th. The leaflet got to the newspaper and was printed. The black ministers also put out this information from their pulpit on Sunday, December 4th. The boycott was supposed to last one day, but after they saw how successful it was, they decided to continue. It was during the early stages of the boycott that the Montgomery Improvement Association, the MIA, was formed to organise and direct the boycott. Dr. King was elected president of the association. There was much speculation as to whether or not the boycott would be successful, because some people still rode the bus, but there were 1,005 participants in the boycott. The MIA contacted the black cab companies in Montgomery, and they agreed to transport people for the same fare they paid on the buses, 10 cents. For the first few days, the taxis and a few private cars handled the transportation. There were many meetings with elected officials and others to try to reach a compromise on the boycott. On December 8, 1955, during the first negotiation with the City Commission, they were told that there was a law limiting taxis to a minimum fare. For this reason, they had to come up with another plan for transportation. The police commissioner issued an order to all taxi companies reminding them that by law they had to charge a minimum fare of 45 cents, and that failing to comply would be a violation of the law and they would be arrested. The MIA called a mass meeting and presented the problem to the people, and they responded by offering their automobiles for transportation. Later on, the black churches acquired station wagons and put the name of their respective churches on them. They began transporting people to and from work. They designated pickup stations and would unload and transfer at these stations. I used my own vehicle and followed many of the station wagons on their routes, taking films of them paying the driver when they got to their destination. I was also able to get on the second floor in one of the buildings next to their pickup station at Monroe and McDonough Streets. With the help of a telephoto lens on the camera, I could see the money changing hands as they loaded and unloaded. These films were later used in state and federal courts. The transportation committee did an excellent job in facilitating transportation as it was handled with precision. The Alabama Council on Human Relations met with the city commissioners, along with King, Abernathy, Fred Gray, Joanne Robinson, and others who represented the MIA. No agreement was reached. Mayor Gale moved to appoint a special committee to discuss the issues and report back to the city commission. He appointed 8 whites and 8 blacks. The committee had a few meetings but never accomplished a settlement in the boycott. The city commissioners took a different approach to end the boycott. They met with 3 black ministers who were not members of the MIA. After the meeting, they announced that a settlement had been reached in the boycott. The press called King, and he denied that a settlement had been reached and that the 3 ministers had acted without any authority from the MIA. The men of Montgomery, composed of white businessmen, met and stated it stood ready to mediate a settlement. 2 of its representatives held discussions with the city commission and bus officials to have the newest version of the reserved seating plan presented to the MIA. The proposed plan was sent to Abernathy, and he said he would present it to the leadership in a mass meeting. After the meeting, Abernathy contacted the mayor of Montgomery and informed them that the membership had voted against the proposal, but thanked them for their effort. Abernathy knew the courts would rule in their favour. Neither side was yielding an inch to the other, and there was no middle ground. On January 23rd, 1956, Mayor W. A. Gale declared there would be no more discussions with the Negro boycott leaders until they were ready to end the boycott. The mayor declared in this dynamic statement of his stand on the boycott that the vast majority of whites in Montgomery did not care whether a Negro ever rode a bus again if it meant that the social fabric of our community be destroyed so the Negroes would start riding the buses again. Mayor Gale stated that we had fooled around on the boycott for long enough, and it had come time to be frank and honest. He added that the Negro leaders had proved again and again that they would say one thing to a white person and another to a Negro about the boycott. The city commission had attempted, with sincerity and honesty, to end the bus boycott in a businesslike fashion. Meetings were held with Negroes at which proposals were made that would have been accepted by any fair-minded group. There seemed to be a belief on the part of the Negroes that they had the white people hemmed up in a corner, and they were not going to give an inch until they forced the white people of our community to submit to their demands, in fact, swallow them. Finally, on December 17, 1956, the Supreme Court rejected the city's appeal, and on December 20, the U.S. Marshals served the papers on the city commissioners. The next morning, King, Abernathy and Rosa Parks gathered at King's house, and when the bus pulled up, King was the first passenger to enter. Thus ended the bus boycott. On December 25, 1956, two buses were fired upon by a sniper. One black woman suffered a minor wound. The next morning, the city commission stated the buses would not run after 5 p.m. The city of Montgomery hired an extra 20 police to protect the buses. Everything returned to normal a couple of weeks later, and the buses returned to their regular schedules. Filing of a lawsuit. On February 1st, 1956, five Montgomery Negro women filed suits in the U.S. District Court, asking that the courts declare Alabama and Montgomery transportation segregation laws unconstitutional. The five women were Aurelia S. Browder, Susie McDonald, Jeanette Reese, Claudette Colvin, and Mary Louise Smith. The suit was entered into the court at 12:45 p.m. by attorneys Fred Gray and Charles Langford. Mayor W. A. Gale, Commissioner Clyde Sellers, and Commissioner Frank Parks were named as individual defendants, as was the City Commission. Police Chief G. J. Ruppenthal, the Montgomery City Bus Lines, and bus drivers James F. Blake and Robert Clear were also named as defendants. The bulky court document specifically requested 1. A final judgment and decree that would declare and define the legal rights of the parties in the controversy. 2. A final judgment and decree that would declare Section 301, Title 30, Code of Alabama, and Sections 10 and 11 of the Montgomery City Code ordering bus segregation null and void. 3. A judgment and decree declaring that the acts of the defendants in seeking to compel the plaintiffs and other Negro citizens to use bus facilities by use of threats, intimidation, and harassment were in violation of the 13th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. 4. A judgment and decree enjoining the defendants from enforcing the state and city statutes and ordinances on grounds that they were unconstitutional. 5. A judgment and decree to prevent the defendants from interfering with Negroes or using force, threats, or intimidation in using private transportation facilities. In the event the U.S. court ruled the state and city laws unconstitutional, it would knock out separate facilities for Negroes and whites at bus and train depots and abolish segregation laws on all buses, trains, streetcars, and other vehicles. After the suit was filed, the members of the city commission said they would continue to enforce segregation laws on Montgomery city lines. Mayor W. A. Gale and two city commissioners said it would be premature to comment on the suit until they could study it. Boycott indictments. On February 13, 1956, the Montgomery County Grand Jury was called to investigate and determine whether Negroes who were boycotting the busing were violating the law. The grand jury was composed of 17 whites and one Negro. After 2 weeks of deliberation, the grand jury indicted 89 persons on boycotting charges. The Negroes were accused of taking an active part in the 12-week-old racial boycott against Montgomery City bus lines. The state law they had violated was Title 14, Section 54, which provides that when two or more persons enter into a conspiracy to prevent the operation of a lawful business without just cause or legal excuse, they shall be guilty of a misdemeanor. Martin Luther King Jr. was the first one tried on the boycott indictments. On March 22, 1956, the trial of King began, with Judge Eugene Carter presiding. After hearing numerous witnesses, Judge Carter found King guilty of violating the state's anti-boycotting law. The penalty was $500 and court costs. The case was appealed, and the other cases were continued until a final appeal was complete in this case. After the 89 Negroes were indicted for boycotting the buses, Alan Poindexter from the Montgomery County Sheriff's Department called me and asked if I could help him fingerprint and photograph those indicted. I agreed to do so. Alan obtained the information required for the back of the fingerprint card, and I fingerprinted and I photographed. This process included Rosa Parks, and this is when the famous photograph was taken of me fingerprinting her. I also fingerprinted King Jr., Ralph Abernathy, and many others. Most of them came in on their own, and the Sheriff's Department only had to pick up a few. I remember 56 of them came in at one time. Everyone was very cordial and friendly, and we had no problems getting them processed. I remember talking to Miss Parks and showing her how I was going to fingerprint her. She was very humble and cooperative. Most of those indicted were male, and they were dressed in suits. The few women indicted were also nicely dressed. I sensed they were sending us a message that they would not be intimidated by these indictments and the boycott would continue. Some individuals were well known to me and we carried on a friendly conversation. It was quite a bit of work getting them all fingerprinted and processed, but it all went very smoothly. On the eve of the grand jury report that brought indictments against the many participants in the boycott movement, Negro leaders rejected a compromise plan for ending the boycott. Terms agreed to previously by the City Commission and the boycott-plagued bus company were turned down flatly by Negroes at a mass meeting called to consider the compromise proposal. The seating arrangement offered in the compromise was similar to the plan rejected by the boycott leaders in previous attempts to end the boycott. The compromised plan included courtesy from bus drivers guaranteed to all patrons and special buses solely for members of each race during peak hours. Abernathy stated, Negroes would gain practically no concessions under the compromise proposal and would have to return to the buses with increased rates. We will walk on until some better proposals are forthcoming from our city fathers. There were several meetings by the City Commission, men of Montgomery, bus company officials and black leaders to resolve the bus boycott, but no compromise was ever reached that would satisfy the black community. Negro group asks franchise for transportation service. It was said there was a very strong demand of Negroes for special transportation. Five Negro leaders filed an application with the Montgomery City Commission, announcing the organization of a transit company and asking for a franchise to serve Negro areas. The petition, made by a business partnership known as the Montgomery Transit Company, requested a certificate of franchise to operate jitneys on six routes in the city. Mayor W. A. Gale stated official action on the Montgomery Transit Company application would be announced at the City Commission meeting the next Tuesday. However, he released a statement by himself and Commissioners Clyde Sellers and Frank Parks on the filing of the application. It stated that if Negroes want to ride a public vehicle, they can ride the city buses. There is an abundance of public transportation in Montgomery for those who want to use it. If there is a group of people in Montgomery who don't want to use this public transportation, that is their fault. We stand firm in our position that the white people of Montgomery are not going to be coerced by the threats and demands of the Negroes now or at any other time. The Negroes who filed the petition were listed as Rufus A. Lewes, J. E. Pierce, J. W. Bonner, Thomas W. Gray, and Ronald R. Young. The address of the transit company was given as 3251 Mobile Drive, the residence of Gray. The application specifically asked, "Applicant desires to establish a jitney transportation service and operate as a common carrier for the transportation of passengers by jitneys along the routes and between the points in the city of Montgomery as showed on the schedule. There is, at present time, a very strong demand for this type of service. No jitney transportation service exists along any of the routes or points proposed to be served by your applicant. Each of the routes zigzags through the city, covering most of the southern and eastern sections." The city commissioners turned down this application, stating that the city of Montgomery had ample public transportation for the people who wanted to use it. The Negroes continued to operate carpools and station wagons from the churches, for which the city would bring legal action in court. The city of Montgomery prepared legal action against the Negro boycotters' carpools. The commission announced these plans after a group representing a trade union publication, the Alabama Labor News, asked for immediate action to halt the carpool operation being carried on by the Negroes in a 10-month protest to racial segregation on city buses. Jack DeBrock, editor of the Labour publication, said that he and others were ready to swear out citizen warrants immediately, if necessary, to stop the carpool operations. Brock's demand was made after Attorney John Cohen, representing the Labour group, outlined double-barrel legal means for halting the boycotters' station wagons and carpool activity. In a statement issued 3 hours after the special conference between the City Commission and the Labour group, the city officials said the city's latest activity in this connection, maintaining segregation, has been the assembling of evidence for action against the operation of so-called carpools. The commission is glad for individuals to take such action as they see fit in their own best interest. However, regardless of whether such action is taken or not, the city will follow its plans for bringing action for an injunction to stop all activities which the city considers illegal at this time. In the morning session, Attorney Cohen declared the carpools a sabotage of franchise transportation in the city, and an effort to do by subterfuge what the commission had denied them the right to do. Cohen was refusing to grant boycotters a franchise for operation of their own bus lines. The Montgomery attorney added that the carpools were an emasculation of city and state laws supported in part by people who hate the South and don't understand it. Cohen particularly cited a section of the state code which states, "Any firm, association, or corporation using the streets of any city for the construction or operation of any public utility cannot do so without first obtaining permission from the City Commission." As evidence of legal authority for immediate action by the City Commission, he asked for their arrests and the trial in the Recorder's Court. The Montgomery City officials petitioned the state court for an injunction banning the Montgomery Improvement Association carpool. The petition stated that the carpools were an unlicensed municipal transportation system and should be banned. The MIA contended that the carpools were a voluntary share-a-ride cooperative. "I produced the films I had taken of the carpools, and they showed the passengers paying the drivers." Judge Eugene Carter granted the city petition and ordered the carpools to stop immediately. The MIA brought suit in federal court, asking the court to stop the state court injunction. "I showed the films in federal court, and Judge Frank Johnson upheld the state court's injunction, and this ended the carpool operation." It was very apparent, after they were turned down by the City Commission for a franchise to operate their own bus lines, that they would not comply with the law. It was taught by King Jr. to not obey a law that you did not agree with, and he stated that this could be done under the banner of civil disobedience. On January the 30th, 1956, a bomb was tossed on the porch of Dr. King's home at 309 S. Jackson Street at about 9:15 p.m. This bomb shattered windows, ripped a hole in the porch, and cracked a porch column. No one was injured. Neighbours reported that a light-coloured automobile was seen at the time of the explosion. It was believed to have stopped in front of the home as a man got out and placed or tossed the bomb on the porch. Coretta King stated she was sitting in the front room of the six-room frame building when she heard footsteps and a thud like a brick hitting on the porch. She was with Mrs. Roscoe Williams, and they feared the thud might be something dangerous, so they went to a room in the rear of the house. As they reached the room, they heard an explosion. In the rear room was King's seven-week-old baby. Van Pruitt, assistant state toxicologist, said he believed the bomb to be either a hand grenade or a half-stick of dynamite. The bomb hit on the south side of the porch, about 2 feet from the concrete steps. The bomb explosion shattered the four windows on the front of the house, sending glass flying inside the living room. The home is now the parsonage of the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church. The Montgomery City Commission offered a $500 reward for the capture and conviction of the persons who bombed the home. Mayor W. A. Gale, speaking for the City Commission, stated, "We do not condone such acts of violence under any condition in our community, and the persons who committed this terrible crime should be punished to the fullest extent of the law. We are asking the cooperation of the entire community to help find the guilty parties. We want any details, however small they may be, that may lead to the arrest of the guilty parties. Not in our community, or any community in this land of ours, should there be such terrible acts of violence. We are strongly in favour of law and order." The police department assigned some investigators to this case, and they were working around the clock to apprehend the persons involved in this crime. A police car was assigned to stay in front of the home. During this same night, four black churches had bombs thrown onto their front lawns. First Baptist Negro Church, Bell Street Baptist, Hutchinson Street Baptist, and Mount Olive Baptist. The total damage to the four churches was estimated at $70,000. A bomb was thrown onto the front lawn of Reverend Robert Gretz, who lived on Cleveland Avenue in Montgomery. He was a white minister at the Negro Trinity Lutheran Church. There was a large hole in his front lawn and his windows were shattered. There was also some structural damage. There were no injuries. The investigators from the police department began working on this case also. On February 1st, 1956, an explosive was tossed into the yard of E.D. Nixon, who lived at 647 Clinton Street. It was the second bombing that week of a property owned by Negroes prominent in the boycott of the Montgomery City Line buses. Nixon is the former state president of the NAACP and a current president of the Montgomery Progressive Democratic Association. Nixon had been prominent in the bus boycott since its inception on December 5, 1955. He and Clifford Durr made the bond for Rosa Parks when she was arrested. Nixon appeared with Parks in Recorder's Court when she was convicted of violating the segregation bus laws on buses. About 250 Negroes gathered at Nixon's home on the night of the bombing and remained relatively silent throughout the investigation by the police. E.D. Nixon was a personal friend of mine and a humanitarian who did not believe in violence. He would help anybody that needed help, regardless of the colour of their skin. I had been in his home and had coffee with him and his wife. He did not receive the recognition he deserved for the role he played in the bus boycott and the civil rights movement. On January 10, 1957, a bomb went off at Reverend Daniel Abernathy's home on 1327 S. Hall Street. It was thrown onto the front lawn. There was considerable damage, but no one was injured. Abernathy's wife and two-year-old child were in the house. Abernathy was in Atlanta, attending a meeting. A black taxi company and service station at the corner of High and Jackson Streets, and a house next door, were bombed on January 26, 1957. An unexploded bomb of 12 sticks of dynamite was found on the porch of King's home. Detective J.D. Shows, who was off duty, spotted some suspicious men at the scene, and he took down the tag number of the car. His alertness and devotion to duty led to the arrests of the bombers. The Montgomery County Grand Jury returned indictments in connection with the racial bombings on February 15, 1957. Two of the men were accused of bombing the occupied home of Reverend Ralph Abernathy, an offence that, if convicted, could bring the death penalty. They were Henry Alexander and Raymond D. York. Alexander was also charged with one of the shootings at City Line's buses. Raymond Sebritt Jr. and Sonny Kyle Livingston Jr. were each charged with the bombings of unoccupied buildings. Misdemeanor charges of conspiracy to commit acts of violence were lodged against Eugene Hall, Charles Bodiford, and Donald Dunlap. Raymond Britt orally admitted to Detective T.J. Ward of his participation in the bombings after 2 hours of questioning. A full statement was later taken by a police stenographer and signed by Britt. Britt directed Ward to a trash pile near Dannelly Field, where he pointed out an abandoned cardboard box which had contained dynamite. Ward said Britt told him he was accompanied on the trip by Henry Alexander and Sonny Kyle Livingstone when the box was discarded. Britt said they had been following King and decided to throw away the box while they were out there. Sonny Kyle Livingstone was charged with bombing one of the four Negro churches on January 10th. Livingstone gave a confession admitting his participation in the bombings after being questioned by Detective J.D. Shows. The first to be tried for the bombings were Raymond Britt and Sonny Kyle Livingstone. They were represented by the law firm of John Blue Hill, William F. Thetford, circuit solicitor for Montgomery County, was the prosecutor. Within an hour after the trial of the two men got underway on May 28, 1957, a legal battle began over the admission of a signed confession. Most of the testimony hinged on the arrest of Sonny Kyle Livingstone. Thetford announced he was prepared to offer evidence of Livingstone's statement and confession. Livingstone's attorney, John Blue Hill, said he had evidence to show that Livingstone was coerced, intimidated, and otherwise mistreated by investigating officers. Both Shows and Ward stated Livingstone had not been intimidated or coerced in any way to give a statement. Judge Carter denied the motion, and Livingstone's confession was admitted to court. Exhibits already offered by the prosecution in evidence included photographs I had taken of the bombed church. The trial lasted a week, with numerous witnesses for both sides being put on the witness stand. The jury arrived at a verdict after 1 hour and 35 minutes. Not guilty verdicts were returned in the trial of Livingstone, and Britt Thetford did an excellent job in prosecuting this case, but an all-white jury did not convict them. The Montgomery Police Department was really disappointed. As we had spent many days and had worked vigorously to bring these people to justice, we were proud of ourselves and knew we had done our jobs in a professional manner. And I think we will leave that here for today, and we will continue tomorrow with integration opponents hang two effigies in Court Square.